Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And let me read from a 1922 Federal Commission report, quote, production of oil cannot long maintain its present rate. Well, I guess what they mean by long, if they took the really long view of long, they may be right. But let's cut to 1977. Jimmy Carter declares that world oil production would reach its zenith by 1985. That is wrong. And just 5 or 10 years ago, the notion of peak oil was trending in the places where notions trend. These are all super wrong. We tend to think that oil is going to run out soon, but it seems like there's much more oil in the earth than the pessimists would have had us believe. In fact, the uncomfortable fact about our climate future is that all our efforts to curb global warming and move off fossil fuels will be thwarted if we keep doing what we've been doing, which is finding more and more fossil fuels everywhere. Yesterday, we saw a report that confirmed that the planet is getting warmer at an unprecedented rate. The last 100 years saw a spike in temperature that used to take 5,000 years. Vince Beiser is a senior editor at Pacific Standard magazine. He recently wrote a long piece about the oil and gas boom taking place around the world and what it means for our environment and economy. Vince, welcome to WNYC. Is Vince there? See, we might have peak oil everywhere, but not peak guest. Hello, Vince. You're there. I hear you.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
There we go.
Okay. Lay out. What does the oil map look like? Where is this oil?
Well, as you say, I mean, it's seemingly practically everywhere you look. There. I mean, basically what's happening is that thanks to new technologies and thanks to rising prices, we're finding oil all over the world. There's huge amounts of new oil and natural gas coming online here in North America, in Brazil, in Africa, in places like Tanzania, Mozambique, Papua New Guinea, even Israel, the one, you know, famously sort of the one country in the Middle East that didn't have any oil. They've just discovered enormous natural gas deposits in their offshore waters. Even Cuba is looking around for some. Asia, I mean, in dozens of places around the world, it turns out there's much, much more oil and natural gas that we can get at than we thought.
We have better ways to detect it. We have better ways, though not perfect ways, quite controversially so, to extract it. So why were we convinced, or were we really truly convinced, that this thing was so finite a resource even during the time when we didn't even know where to find all the oil?
Well, it's two things. As you say, there's two things involved in getting fossil fuels out. One is you've got to know that they're there, and two is then you've got to be able to get them out. So in some cases, we've known for a long time that there was oil or gas there. Like, you know, everybody's heard about fracking. It's happening so much in the U.S., in the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, and especially in North Dakota and in Texas as well. We've known for a long time, I mean, the oil industry has known for decades, that there was a lot of oil and gas trapped underground there. The problem was they just couldn't get to it. What happens with fracking is you've got oil and gas that are trapped in really dense rock. It's really hard to get out. Normally, with conventional wells, with sort of the wells we've been relying on for a long time, what happens is you dig a hole in the ground, you drill a hole down into the ground, and the oil just flows through the rock. It's really porous rock. And it flows through kind of like, you know, when you're at the beach and you dig a hole down into the sand, and when you get down to a certain level, the seawater just starts pouring in. It's just flowing right through the grains of sand.
Mm-hmm.
That's how a conventional oil well works. In these shale formations, the rock is much more dense, and the oil can't just flow through it like that. So you have to crack it. You have to shatter the rock, which is what you do with fracking. And it's only in the last 8-10 years that we've figured out two things. One is how to frack that rock, how to get down deep enough and shatter that rock thoroughly enough to free that oil and gas so it can flow into a wellbore. And also we've perfected the art of horizontal drilling, which is a technology that continues to blow my mind. It's basically where we, you know, drill a hole down into the ground and then are able to turn the drill almost 90 degrees and have it go sideways through the Earth for miles. So imagine a drill, you know, digging its way under the ground horizontally for miles. Then you shatter the rock around it, and all that oil and gas comes pouring in. So those are very new technologies that are allowing us to tap those fossil fuels that we've known about for a long time.
Horizontal drilling, or a straw to make one drink someone else's milkshake, as There Will Be Blood would present that analogy.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when you read about, you know, I've read information about peak oil, and it kind of reads a little bit like people who believe in, like, the gold bugs, right? People who more than just believe in the gold standard, but, you know, think we should revert to gold. It's not as if they're presenting, hey, here's a set of facts that leads me to a conclusion based on geological evidence. It's, you know, the peak oil is more like a movement or a belief system. Has there been any backing away from that idea among the people who propagate the idea of peak oil? Have they taken into account what the world is telling us over the last decade?
Oh, good God, yes. I mean, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, it wasn't just sort of, you know, it wasn't just kind of a wacky, culty gold bug thing to be talking about peak oil. That's something the whole oil industry was talking about. It's something that, you know, national governments were talking about. It was a really serious concern. People really thought that we were on our way soon to running out of oil, or at least running short of it. And then in a very short time, that all flipped around. A big part of it was fracking. Another really big part of it is offshore, is these huge amounts of fossil fuels that we're finding underneath the ocean. I mean, that's a field that, you know, almost didn't exist 10 years ago and now is bringing up millions and millions of barrels of oil a day from way underneath the ocean. So there's definitely still a coterie of folks out there who are warning that the end is nigh.
Yeah.
But across the industry, you know, and people who make their livings studying this stuff, there's been almost a 180-degree shift, and they're now worried more about overproduction. They're worried about producing too much and bringing the price down.
Yeah. And in this country, a stat that you have in the article that I found eye-opening was, you know, 10 years ago, 2/3 of our oil was imported. But now the majority of U.S. oil consumption is from U.S. oil. Is that right?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's amazing. So here it all adds up to this. I think this is the big fundamental question in the middle of the entire discussion. Not if we were an oil company and not if, you know, we're deciding whether to buy a Prius or a Chevy, but just for society. All this oil that we're now finding that is now extractable, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that depends on who you are. If you're an oil company, it's great. If you're one of these countries that never had an energy industry before and now all of a sudden you're a big oil player, it's great. If you're Israel, this is great news. If you're Brazil, where they have just in the last few years discovered billions and billions of barrels of oil underneath their waters, it's great, at least in the short term. A lot of people are making a lot of money off this. A lot of individual countries are already winning big, including ours, by the way. I mean, the whole fracking thing has been for whatever the environmental controversy around it, it's definitely been a shot in the arm for the economy. But big picture, long term for the planet, we may be screwed. We may just end up cooking the planet.
Yeah, that's the downside. So I want to play this clip. This is the incoming, yet to be confirmed, but the man who will be Energy Secretary, Ernest Moniz, and he was laying out his vision for our energy future.
So the formula is, in fact, for this 10 years, demand management, gas for coal, and innovate like hell, so that the zero carbon alternatives can have cost reductions and can get driven into the marketplace earlier.
He's basically conceding that for 10 years, we're going to have to rely on fossil fuels, but we can aggressively pursue zero carbon alternatives. But if fossil fuel is so plentiful, sure, that's, I guess, best case scenario. Hey, let's use the fuel that we have and then let's innovate and get off the fuel. But if it's so plentiful, won't the incentive to get off it be reduced?
Yeah, I mean, that's already happening. I mean, cheap natural gas, especially the natural gas that we're getting from fracking, is really, it's kneecapping the renewable industries. The solar and wind have taken a big hit because of it. I mean, Slim Pickens, or I'm sorry, T Boone Pickens. I always do that.
Yeah.
T Boone Pickens is the big, he's a big energy mogul in Texas. He said last year that he has lost $100 million on his wind farms. He's an oil and gas guy who made a big move into wind farms recently, and then last year he practically gave up. He said he's lost $100 million on his wind farms because they couldn't compete with cheap natural gas.
And there's nothing. I mean, the government can't make up that difference. It has to be the economy and natural economic drivers to get to make it so that alternative energy is just the more logical alternative.
Yeah, I mean, the government can certainly help. There are tax incentives that they give to renewables that help out. You know, obviously the political climate is really tough for that in the wake of the whole Solyndra scandal. That certainly didn't make things any easier for them. But, it's also true that the government has given all kinds of boosts to the oil and gas industry over the years, tax breaks. So the Department of Energy does all kinds of research that redounds to their benefit. And they do some of that with renewables, too, but not nearly to the same extent. The one thing that I kept wondering as I was doing this story is, mm-hmm. I mean, the industry is so huge, and they put such incredible resources into developing their technology, and you just have to wonder if those billions and billions of dollars were spent not on developing, you know, more effective subsea drills or better fracking systems, if they were put into advancing solar or wind technology, we might be in a very different place.
We're speaking.
But as it is, you know, the amount of money going into renewables is a tiny fraction of what's going into fossil fuels.
We're speaking with Vince Beiser, a senior editor of Pacific Standard. His article, The Deluge, looks at the massive amounts of oil and gas being discovered throughout the world. What am I not getting about the law of supply and demand when I look at gas prices and realize what your article is saying? Wait, there's a lot more demand, and yet the price isn't going down.
Yeah, it's that's a tricky one to get your head around. Basically, the short answer is that there's more supply, but there is more demand. I mean, around the world, demand is going up very fast mm-hmm. for oil, because China, India, and other countries, their economies are booming. And all of those people who live there, they want their own cars. They want their washing machines. They want all the good stuff that we've got here. And that takes power, and especially it takes oil. So worldwide, demand is pretty much keeping pace with supply. And even though we're pulling up a lot more oil in this country than we used to, it's being pulled up. Basically, all the oil companies are multinational companies, and they sell their oil wherever they can get the best price. So as long as worldwide demand stays high, the price of oil stays high even in this country.
And I think this week,
it's a global commodity.
I think this week China surpassed the U.S. as the biggest oil importer on the planet.
Is that right? I missed that.
This is,
but it doesn't surprise me. They've been on that track for a while.
This is what I have read and have been told. Matt from Brooklyn is giving us a call, something about geopolitics in Haiti. What's on your mind, Matt?
Yes, after the earthquake in Haiti, they have found a lot of oil in Haiti, more than the oil in Iraq. So I'd like to know why they don't talk about it. What are they going to do? Because they're mentioning a lot of other countries have oil. Nobody ever says anything about the Haitian oil. And after the earthquake, almost every country sent boats with medicine, with help, surround the island to help. But the United States turned them back. And they took the country hostage. They sent 20,000 American soldiers in Haiti. And Haiti have gold and diamonds, and they collect all this money to help the Haitian, and the Haitian are still under the tent. So I don't know. I would like to know why they hate the Haitians so much. And in reality, it was the Haitian who fought for America,
all right, well,
for their independence against England.
All right, Matt. It's going far afield. But do you know about the Haitian oil, Vince?
That's the first I've heard about there being any oil in Haiti. I do know they think there might be a lot of natural gas offshore in Cuba.
Yeah.
That's something that they've been looking for. That's the first I've heard in Haiti. I would love to believe it. I mean, I was in Haiti myself right after the earthquake, and man, that country needs every break it can get.
I mean, but let's just take the general geopolitical question. You know, here we have Hugo Chavez's death, and of course, so much of his what he was able to do, for good or ill, was based on the amount of oil that that Venezuela had. And as oil prices rose, I mean, you could track his popularity and success with the price of oil pretty closely. You know, does the finding the massive reserves, is this just an indication that we're really not going to do anything to fundamentally change our dependence on foreign oil and our sometimes coddling of dictators who control oil?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, one of the upsides from this oil boom is that, in fact, there's good reason to hope that the U.S. at least is not going to have to cozy up quite so much to some of these horrible regimes that we've been so friendly with over the years. Because, in fact, American dependence on foreign oil is dropping really fast, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
And, in fact, the Energy Information Administration predicts that our total imports of oil and other energy is going to drop to about 13% in the next 20 years, which is way down from what it's been. So it should mean that places like, you know, some of these really troublesome petrostates like Iran, like Venezuela, like Russia, they really stand to be big losers in this new era, in the years very soon to come, because they're going to lose a lot of their influence.
Yeah, except
a lot of their geopolitical influence.
Except, as you also mentioned, since China is now this huge importer of energy, look at what they've done to Africa. And, you know, not all petrol states are in the Middle East. Some of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, Equatorial Guinea, and places like that.
Yep. No, I mean, listen, they call it the resource curse. I mean, very often, a lot of countries, when they find oil, they end up worse off than before. You know, it doesn't go to enrich the country. It just gets, you know, it gets pocketed by who's ever at the top of the pyramid, and the country ends up, suffering all kinds of environmental damage, and they end up worse off than before. Equatorial Guinea is a great example.
Right, where the per capita income on paper seems good, but if you look at the actual median income, it's, you know, just a few families having almost all the wealth and so many people living in poverty.
Exactly. On the other hand, that doesn't always have to happen. I mean, it depends a lot on the country, and it depends a lot on who's calling the shots. I mean, Brazil, for instance, like I said, they're on track to be one of the world's top five oil producers within the next few years. And, it's not the most democratic, it's not the most enlightened country in the world, but so far they're doing a much better job of distributing the wealth and sort of, sharing it around and using it for more sustainable kind of development.
It is the blessing. Oil is the blessing and the curse of modernity.
Exactly.
Vince Beiser, senior editor at Pacific Standard, he wrote The Deluge. There's a lot of oil in the world, and The Deluge is the article that chronicles it all. Vince, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. It's great talking with you.
And in a moment, Trading Bases, a story about Wall Street gambling and baseball, not necessarily in that order, though I think we will go in that order in our show. Stay with us.